Matthew 17:24-17:27. The sixth talk about Jesus' teaching on Phariseeism was presented by Earl Craig on September 18, 2005 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I have invited a good friend of mine to teach this morning. He was up here. Earl Craig is on the board of Gutenberg College, and he had to come up here for a board meeting. He's a friend of mine, has been a friend of mine for somewhere in the vicinity of 30 years. We went to Africa together this past summer, and Earl taught a course on the Pentateuch while I taught a course on Romans. And he and the staff of a church in Southern California have forged, I think, a fairly meaningful and substantial relationship and friendship over that distance. I think we should become a denomination. We'll be the two churches, isn't it? So I've asked him to teach, and I think from what he said, it should be a good balance to what I've been teaching. I want to finish Matthew 23 next week, so I'll return to that and finish that next week. But in the meantime, Earl's going to teach us out of the Gospel of Matthew, earlier in Matthew. So thank you, Earl.
Good morning. The first thing that I want to do is to give you an internet address for the pictures that I took in Africa when Jack and I were there teaching at Northrise University in Zambia. If you'd like to just see a little bit of what that place is like, the internet address is zambia05.shutterfly.com. Zambia05.shutterfly.com. There are three albums. If you're familiar with shutterfly.com, there are three albums there. One is of pictures of Moffat and Doreen's home. That's where Moffat and Doreen are the directors of Northwise University, the founders there. And kind of their neighborhood gives you a sense of just sort of where they live and on the outskirts of the city of Ndola. Then another album is the school itself, Northrise University, the students, and you'll see Jack in all his glory there as he is teaching the class that he was. And then a third album is of the city of Ndola as we're driving around in Moffat's microbus. And I'm taking pictures as quickly as I can with as fast a shutter speed as possible to try to capture just some of the life there in the city. So if you didn't get that internet address, ask me afterwards. I'll be glad to give it again. The 20th century physicist Richard Feynman describes a rose. And in his description of the rose, when he writes, he says that, you know, he basically can describe the rose as anybody else could. Any of us sort of normal human beings, non-physicists, non-scientists, could describe the rose the way he does. But because he understands the molecular, the atomic, and the subatomic processes that are going on inside that rose, that knowledge gives him, it sort of enriches his experience in his observation of the rose and even his description of the rose. Well, I'd like you to think of the passage that we're going to look at a little bit along those lines. The passage is in Matthew 17, if you want to turn there with me, verses 24 through 27. As I thought about this passage more and more, it seems to me that, I started asking myself the question, you know, what if this passage weren't in the Bible? Would it matter that much? Because it's a different sort of story, a little obscure. The lesson that we're going to learn, or lessons that we're going to learn from this story, you probably already know, at least to some extent, even intuitively, as in your understanding of the gospel. So would you be all that much worse off if this passage weren't even here and I didn't teach it this morning? You know, maybe not. And that may be true even of a lot of passages of the Bible, the more that I think about it. I mean, the gospel is relatively simple. And yet, it's passages like this one that remind me of Richard Feynman's own, his person and his knowledge and his wisdom and understanding with regard to physics, is that I hope that what this passage would do is that it would provide us with a little more understanding of the molecular and the atomic and the subatomic processes that are going on inside the created reality that our transcendent Creator has made, and that we are a part of this story. So keep that in mind as we go through this then. And I'll look forward to stopping here in about half an hour or so and giving you an opportunity to help me better understand this passage with your questions and comments too. The way we're going to approach this is to first look at this short pericope here in verses 24 through 27 of chapter 17 of Matthew. And I want to ask a few questions, raise a few questions, interpretive questions about what may be going on here. And then we'll go back to an Old Testament passage, to Exodus chapter 30. And I think kind of build or find a passage that allows us to understand what's going on in this story with respect to Jesus and give us some foundation for it. So then we'll come back to Matthew 17, fill in the blanks, and then draw some lessons from the story after that. Okay, so our first look then at this passage, Matthew 17, 24 through 27. Let me read it to you. When they came to Capernaum, those who collected the 2 drachma tax came to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the 2 drachma tax?" And he said, "Yes." And when he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth collect customs or poll tax? From their sons or from strangers?" And when Peter said, "From strangers," Jesus said to him, "Then the sons are exempt. However, so that we do not offend them, go to the sea and throw in a hook and take the first fish that comes up. And when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for you and me." Perfectly clear, isn't it? What's going on here in this passage? Verse 24, when they came to Capernaum, they being Jesus and his apostles, probably some other disciples too in this entourage, and they come to Capernaum. Having been up north of there, Capernaum is on the northern sea, northern shore of the Sea of Galilee. This is not too far from where Jesus would have taught the Sermon on the Mount way back in chapter 5 of Matthew. Capernaum, I believe, also was where Peter lived, and in fact this house that he ends up going into may have been perhaps even his house. But it says that those who collected the 2 drachma tax came to Peter, and they ask him, and it's interesting that they're asking Peter here and not Jesus directly, but they ask him, "Does your teacher, your rabbi," and there'd be many rabbis in the Israel area at that time, people who would gather around them, disciples, and be teaching them about the Old Testament, about God, but they ask him Peter's teacher is going to pay the 2 drachma tax. And the question that we want to raise here is exactly what is this tax? Is it a civil tax or is it a religious tax? And you read various commentators and you'll find that some think that this is the issue here is a civil tax, similar to a story in Matthew 22 where Jesus gets asked directly sort of a similar question. And he takes a coin, you recall, and he says, you know, whose image is on this coin? And, well, it's Caesar's. Well, then render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's. So there are some commentators who think that this passage is actually parallel with that, talking about basically the same thing. And that is it appropriate for your teacher, Peter, to pay taxes to Rome? Now, some of your Bibles, if you're using the NIV or the New King James Version, they will translate this 2 drachma tax actually as the temple tax. So those versions are being very interpretive there. And they're saying, no, this isn't a civil tax. The issue here is a religious tax, so-called temple tax, one that would be raised in order to support the temple in Jerusalem. So that's one of the questions we want to raise here. In verse 25, we see Peter, just right out of the chutes, you know, being the Peter that he is, immediate response he gives to these people, well, absolutely, my rabbi pays this tax. And so he goes into the house, ostensibly, to collect it from Jesus in order to pay it. But before a word is out of Peter's mouth, Jesus has a question for him. And this question is, do the rulers, the kings of the earth, collect customs or poll tax from their sons or from their daughters? I'm sorry, from strangers. Sorry, how would that? No, let's not even go there. Or from strangers. Well, Jesus is either telling a parable here, or he's directly addressing the issue. If he's directly addressing the issue, then the issue is a civil tax. Do the kings, that is, when we're talking about a civil tax, one where you would pay something to a civil government, does the civil government collect taxes from its own family, or does it collect taxes from strangers? That would be the way to understand what Jesus was saying here. It's either that, if he's directly addressing the issue, or it's a parable, where Jesus is using a civil government situation to make a point about a religious situation. So one or two or the other. Where in which case, if it's the a religious issue, then we've got to figure out who are the kings of the earth, to whom do they correspond in this religious setting, and therefore who also are the sons versus the strangers. So we'll come back to that. Verse 26, Peter answers the question also very quickly, probably right out of his own culture. I mean, it would seem as though if you just simply were to apply this story, the question that Jesus asked, directly to the Roman civil government, Peter knows that the sons of the Caesars don't have to pay poll tax. It's other people who have to do so outside of the family of Caesar. That's the folks that end up having to pay this tax. So Peter answers immediately, strangers. And Jesus then responds to him. His conclusion is, well, then the sons are exempt. Literally, the Greek is free. Yeah? Okay. Seems that way. However, Jesus says in verse 27, so that we do not offend them, go to the sea, throw a fish hook into it. First fish that you take out of the sea, open its mouth, you'll find a shekel there, a coin, and give that to them and pay the tax for you and me. Well, okay. That's sort of a strange part of this story, too. Question we want to ask is, what does he mean by offend? Does Jesus saying that he never wants to do anything that might hurt people's feelings, perhaps, so we don't offend them? Well, we better go ahead and pay this tax. Or maybe that he never wants to speak out against even those who might be wrong for fear that he might sound unloving towards them? And besides which, who is a them in this as he's addressing them here? The kings of the earth, Caesar in this case, if it's a direct issue towards the civil government that Jesus is talking about, or maybe the temple officials and those who are collecting this tax on behalf of the temple officials in Jerusalem, those are the ones that he means here. So that's the story. Now, how do we figure out what's going on a little bit better with this thing? Well, the best way to do that is to go back to Exodus chapter 30, I think. So if you would turn with me there. And let me read to you Exodus 30, verses 11 through 16. Exodus chapter 30, verses 11 through 16. Before I do so, though, I want to remind you that Exodus 30, 11 through 16, it's right smack dab in the middle of God's instructions to the nation of Israel at Mount Sinai, after he has rescued this group of people, his people, from Egypt. They're in the Sinai desert, 1500 BC or so. Moses is their leader. They cross the Red Sea. They're now receiving the Mosaic Covenant, the covenant that God is making with them at this mountain, that they are then to observe and keep as they go into the land that God has promised them, the land of Canaan, where He will lead them. This paragraph is right smack dab in the middle of God's instructions about the building of this sort of portable temple, tabernacle it's called, that the people are to use, where they should understand that it's there in their midst that God will dwell in that tabernacle. It's there in their midst that where they are to come and to worship God. But it's to be built according to His specifications. So He's giving them instructions about exactly how to build it. And then later on in Exodus, they will actually build it. So right smack dab in the middle of these instructions, you get this. Verse 11, chapter 30 of Exodus. And the Lord also spoke to Moses, saying, "When you take a census of the sons of Israel to number them, then each of them shall give a ransom for himself to the Lord when you number them, so that there will be no plague among them when you number them. This is what everyone who is numbered shall give, half a shekel, according to the shekel of the sanctuary." The shekel is 20 gerahs, just in case you were wondering. "Half a shekel is a contribution to the Lord. Everyone who is numbered from 20 years old and older, old and over, shall give the contribution to the Lord. The rich shall not pay more, and the poor shall not pay less than the half shekel, when you give the contribution to the Lord to make atonement for yourselves. You shall take the atonement money from the sons of Israel, and shall give it for the service of the tent of meeting, that it may be a memorial for the sons of Israel before the Lord, to make atonement for yourselves." So the first thing we see in this passage is that God is saying at the time of the taking of the census of the Israelites, and it would be the males, 20 years and older, Moses is to collect from them this, let's call it, tax. Well, one of the questions that we need to ask in this passage is, when was this census supposed to be taken? And is there any indication about how often it was to be taken? Well, this is not actually clear, but we'll come back to it nevertheless in a minute. In verse 13, though, I want to point out to you that the words half a shekel, at least in the New American Standard here, you're probably familiar with the fact that the Old Testament was written in Hebrew for the most part. There was a Greek translation of the Old Testament done around 250 B.C. and beyond that by Jews who felt they needed to translate the Hebrew into the Old Testament into Greek, because after Alexander the Great had done his thing and swept down through Palestine, the Palestinian area, and Egypt, so many people, including Jews, had embraced the Greek culture and language that many Jews were losing their ability to speak Hebrew. And so to ensure that the Jews, those who were now more Greek-speaking, would stay in touch with the scriptures, Jewish scholars started translating the Old Testament into Greek. Well, the Greek translation of the phrase half a shekel is the same, well, at least the word shekel, is the same word as in our story in Matthew 17, two drachma. All right? So there, at least, we have a linguistic connection between this story and what's going on in the story in Matthew 17. In addition to that, let's just look briefly at the purpose for why God commanded Moses to collect this levy or tribute or tax. In verse 12, we see that it's to be a ransom for the person who is paying this. And the ransom is simply the noun form of the verb to make atonement down in verse 15. In other words, this is a reference to sin, a reference to the purpose for this being to make a sort of sacrifice for sin. Because this word is also used with respect to the sacrifice of animals, of bulls and goats. So one purpose God is saying is that to pay this as a ransom for the person. In verse 12 also, another purpose is that in order that there might not be any plague among the people of Israel. And I assume that this is referring to the plagues of Egypt that the Egyptians had just suffered under. Third purpose in verse 14 is that this was to be a gift to Yahweh. Fourthly, that this was to make atonement, the verb form, verb form here, of the noun ransom back up in verse 12. The Septuagint, the Greek translation, uses the word appease or propitiate, a word that we're familiar with in the New Testament. Jesus is our propitiation. He is the one who quenches God's anger towards us as because of our sin. He does that for us. So this payment of this half shekel was to make atonement in a similar manner, therefore also sort of a reference to sin. In a fifth purpose in verse 16, this is for the service of the tent of the meeting. The word could be construction, maybe just for the support of the actual, you know, goings on there of the tabernacle as the priests carried out the sacrifices for the people, perhaps even kind of paying them, one could understand this to be. And then a sixth purpose in verse 16, this is to be a memorial for the sons of Israel before Yahweh. Well, I think this passage is the basis for our understanding what's going on in Matthew 17. But just a couple more comments about some other passages to kind of maybe help fill in the blanks. If I were to read to you Exodus 38, verses 21 through 28, what we'd find is Moses has collected this tax, silver and gold. And that silver and gold was then used for the construction of the tabernacle. The silver for building pedestals for the pillars, the gold, I assume, for kind of overlay. So what we learn from Exodus 30 and 38 is that this census was taken, more than anything else, God is referring specifically to a census that was going to be taken at that time, and the money collected in order to build the tabernacle. Then if I were to go on to 2 Chronicles chapter 24, what we'd find there is that this would be 700 years later. We've jumped from 1500 B.C. to 800 B.C., around 800 B.C., King Joash of the southern kingdom of Judah. Recall the kingdom of Israel got split into the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom after Solomon died. Both kingdoms are still in existence. But in the southern kingdom, King Joash, who rules from Jerusalem, where the temple is that Solomon had built about 200 years earlier, around 1000 B.C., it's in disrepair. And so Joash says to the priests, go out and collect what he calls literally the levy of Moses, or the tribute of Moses, referring probably, most probably I'd say, to this passage here in Exodus chapter 30, where we see Joash say, you know, that's a good principle that God established in Exodus chapter 30 for the construction of the tabernacle. Let's take that principle, collect this levy or tribute or tax of Moses, and use that money to repair the temple now in 800 B.C. And so they did that. Nehemiah 10, approximately 300 years later, around 500 B.C., after the rebuilding of the temple, after the Babylonian captivity and the people have returned from Babylon, they gather around after this rebuilding of this would be the second temple, and they rededicate themselves to God, and they decide that annually they should collect a tax in order to support the temple. It may have even been from Nehemiah 10 that, as some commentators state, that by the time we get around then to Jesus' day, that on an annual basis, the temple authorities in Jerusalem were collecting a tax, and it probably was called, therefore, this 2 drachma that then would be something that everyone would every sort of respectable God-worshipping Jew would want to pay as part of their worship of God. Okay, so little background material there. Now let's go back to Matthew 17, see if we can unravel this thing and draw its lessons from it. So when they came to Jerusalem, those that collected the 2 drachma tax. What kind of tax are we talking about? I think a religious one. This was a tax that was, then we can assume, that was being collected to maintain the temple based upon the principle established in Exodus chapter 30. But why are they asking Jesus if he's going to pay it? I mean, he's got to be, 31 years old. You'd assume that he's probably paid it before, perhaps. I'm not really sure why they're even asking at this point. Maybe he's paid it in Nazareth, but he hasn't paid it in Capernaum, so they're not aware. The tax officials in Nazareth didn't communicate with the folks in Capernaum, so they're not aware of whether or not he pays it. So they're asking here. So those who are collecting this tax would be designated officials by the temple authorities in Jerusalem, and they're asking this question. Peter says, well, of course, my rabbi is just as good a God-worshipping Jew as any rabbi. Of course he's going to pay this tax, which is customary for all of us Jews to pay. But as before the words are even out of Peter's mouth, Yeshua, are you going to pay this tax? Jesus has this question for him. What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth collect customs or poll tax? From their sons or from strangers? And Peter answers, from strangers. And Jesus says to him in verse 26, then the sons are exempt. Well, I think this is a parable, not a direct reference then, because this isn't an issue of a civil tax. It's a religious tax. So Jesus uses a civil story or a story about civil governments to teach a lesson to, certainly to Peter here, about this religious tax. Well, who are the kings of the earth then? Well, they would correspond, I think, to God, Jesus' Father. And what Jesus is saying then is that the Son, he's the Son. As the Son of God, he is the Son of the ruler of the earth. And as it's true in the civil situation, that Caesar doesn't require his sons to pay the poll tax, neither is God requiring that he, Jesus, pay this tax to the temple. In other words, he, the Son of God, the Son of the Father, the Son of the ruler of the earth, he is exempt from paying this temple tax. But why? Well, one obvious thing is that he certainly has a unique relationship with the Father. As the Son of God, he is the Messiah, capital M. Certainly every king of Israel ruling in Jerusalem, starting from David, could call himself a Messiah, but small m, or anointed one, which is what Messiah means, small a, or even Christ, small c. All those words refer to the same thing. But here Jesus is saying, but I'm a little different from David. I am the incarnate God, you've got to understand. So I am exempt from this tax because I am the Messiah, capital M, the Son of God, capital S. That certainly would be one thing that would be obvious here. So that if these collectors of this tax really understood the person about whom they're asking this question, does your rabbi pay this tax? They would collect the taxes and give them to Jesus. Oh, okay, cool. Well, then I understand correctly who you really are. Then shouldn't you receive this tax? Especially since Jesus is the one who has said he's the temple. There's a reference to his saying that. But another reason why I think Jesus, we could say, drawing from Exodus chapter 30 and why Jesus is exempt from this tax, is because, as I read to you those purposes in Exodus chapter 30, we noticed that the purpose for the tax was to make propitiation for one's sin before God, to make atonement for one's sin before God. Well, let me ask you, and I hope you've been relatively well taught here at Reformation Fellowship, does Jesus need to make atonement for his sins before God the Father? The answer to that is, oh, phew, okay, good. We don't have to go into a greater explanation on that. Then no. So Jesus is saying, I think also, that if you understand the purpose of that tax, which is to build this temple where we come and seek God's mercy, That's obviously the last thing I have to do as the Messiah, capital M, the Son of God, capital S. I am the morally perfect God-man, incarnate God, who's come to save you from your sins. So that too, then, obviously would make him exempt from paying this tax. And yet, verse 27, Jesus does pay it, interestingly enough. Now, two things here in verse 27, when he says, however, so that we do not offend them, go to the sea and do your thing, Peter, as a fisherman, and follow through with my instructions there about grabbing this this coin out of the fish's mouth. What is it, first thing is, that we want to explore here in verse 27, what does it mean that Jesus does not want to offend the temple authorities? Well, I don't think it means that he doesn't want to hurt their feelings. And it also doesn't mean that he doesn't want to criticize them. But I think what it does mean is that he doesn't want to give the impression that he is anti-God by being anti-Mosaic covenant, by being anti-temple, by being anti-temple tax. You see, if he didn't pay the tax, then it would be easy for the temple authorities, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Sanhedrin, the Jewish council, to get the impression that Jesus just doesn't like God because he's not willing to support what God has prescribed under the Mosaic covenant. But Jesus doesn't want to give that impression here. So he's saying that the temple authorities definitely are right to believe that this tax was a good idea in worshiping God. That they're upholding the truth by collecting this tax. And Jesus doesn't want to give the impression that he doesn't also uphold the truth. That's the first thing from verse 27. The second thing, though, is what about Jesus telling Peter to acquire this coin in a miraculous way, this 4-drachma piece that will pay for both Jesus and Peter's temple taxes? Well, Jesus, as with other miracles, I think is simply manifesting his messiahship to Peter, at least, through this miracle, further driving home the point to Peter. Peter, now, you know who I am, right? I'm the Messiah. Let me show you that one more time by this miracle. And of course, we have to wonder if perhaps what Peter might have said to the tax collectors after he took this, you know, 4-drachma piece to the tax collectors. Here's your payment of the tax. And by the way, I also got this coin out of the mouth of a fish from the Sea of Galilee. I mean, can you hear the tax collectors? Yeah, right. You know, what have you been smoking, Peter? I mean, you did what? Whether or not he told that story, we have it as a means to continue to instruct us. So, what lessons then do we learn from this passage? Well, from this very last part, Jesus once again explaining and demonstrating his role and authority as the Messiah. That word Messiah and all the rights and privileges and responsibilities that go with us, go with that, with those rights and privileges and responsibilities. So that those of us then who read a story like this, that hopefully it's like Richard Feynman's understanding of the molecular, atomic, and subatomic processes of the rose. It's one more story to enrich our own understanding of Jesus as the Messiah. I mean, did I really need this story to tell me that? Lots of other stories that tell me that. No, I really don't. But honestly, the more I study this story and think about it, the more fascinated I am by it and intrigued by it. And I think I feel the same way that Richard Feynman does, you know, or did. I think he may have passed away by now. Maybe he still does. Well, we won't get into that either. But the same sort of rush, you know, the excitement. Wow, here's another interesting story that reminds me that Jesus of Nazareth is my Messiah. The Son of God died for me, saved me from my sins. that I might seek God's mercy and obtain the promise of eternal life. Just another enriching experience to drive that home to me as a believer. Or, if you're not a believer in Jesus Christ yet, that you would look at a story like this and go, well, gosh, if that's who He is, this Son of the Father, who's exempt from the temple tax because they ought to be paying it to Him, and He's a miracle worker to prove that He is the one who was sent to die for my sins, then you as a non-believer hopefully would look at this and go, I want to become a believer. To be persuaded and convinced of with just a simple story like this, as God would work in your heart. And then another lesson, and this second lesson requires that we look briefly at Matthew 15 and Matthew 23, if you don't mind. In Matthew 15, because I want to think about this issue in verse 27 of Matthew 17 of Jesus not wanting to offend the temple authorities. Because it seems in other places, and Jack has been teaching you on this from Matthew 23, it seems in other times Jesus has no problem offending the Jewish leadership. Chapter 15, verse 1, then the Pharisees and scribes came to Jesus from Jerusalem and said, why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat bread. And then if you drop down to verses 10 and 11, after Jesus called the crowd to him, he said to them, hear and understand. It is not what enters into the mouth that defiles the man, but what proceeds out of the mouth. This defiles the man. And the disciples came and said to him, do you know that the Pharisees were offended? Same word, all right? Were offended when they heard this statement? And Jesus answered and said, every plant which my heavenly Father did not plant shall be uprooted. Let them alone. They are blind guides of the blind, and if a blind man guides a blind man, both will fall into a pit. Basically, he says, they're offended, big deal. Completely different from how he's thinking about the Jewish authorities in chapter 17. Same sort of thing as you've been seeing in chapter 23 of Matthew, where, just to look at a couple of verses there, where Jesus says in verse 2 of chapter 23, the scribes and the Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moses. Therefore, all that they tell you, do and observe, but do not do according to their deeds, for they say things and do not do them. Jesus is saying it's a good thing that these men have decided to teach the Old Testament to you. That's great. That's exactly what ought to happen. But there's a problem with their perspective on God and on their teaching. So, In chapter 27, chapter 17 rather, sorry, in verse 27, what we have then is Jesus saying, I don't want to offend them, meaning one thing, but then in chapters 15 and 23 we get the impression that he doesn't mind offending the Jewish authorities. Well, what's the upshot of this? Two things, I think, regarding this. One is this. Jesus, on the one hand, from Matthew 17, does not want to give the appearance of rejecting the truth of God when the Pharisees are upholding that truth. But then on the other hand, secondly here, Jesus does intentionally criticize the Pharisees when they misrepresent the truth. That when the Pharisees are misrepresenting the truth, are distorting the truth of the Old Testament, Jesus will offend them all day long, if that's necessary or available as an opportunity. But when they're upholding the truth by this good thing of collecting the temple tax, he's saying, no, I don't want to give the impression that I'm anti-God in this situation. That, I think, is the major lesson that we need to take from this then, is to think about for ourselves what this means for us as Christians. Let me put it this way. First of all, as a Christian should not want to give the appearance of rejecting the truth of Christianity as God has provided it for us in the Bible when other Christians, people who proclaim to be Christians, are upholding the truth, at least to some extent. On the other hand, though, that's sort of Matthew 17. On the other hand, Matthew 15 and 23, a Christian humbly and graciously, because he ain't Jesus, I'm not Jesus, does intentionally criticize other Christians when they misrepresent the truth. That's Matthew 15 and 23. So there's a balance here. On the one hand, there are people that I know I just flat out disagree with in terms of what the gospel really is. People who believe that their relationship with God is more one of a sort of a quid pro quo relationship. I do all these great religious things and then God blesses me with this huge ministry, which I don't have, down in Southern California, with a family that has it act completely together, which I don't have, down in Southern California, with a successful business, which also I don't have, down in Southern California, with complete and just overflowing joy and emotional and psychological well-being, which I don't have either. If you wake up with me at 3 o'clock in the morning and the waves of fear and anxiety that come over me every night, because just my makeup is that kind of person. And I keep thinking, if I just do the right thing, I can get rid of all that stuff and I can make my life truly the abundant life. That teaching is just, it's ubiquitous in the Christian community. I heartily disagree with that. Not just simply because I haven't been able to get it to work, you know, in my own life, but also I just don't think that that's true. As well as the emphasis, as Ron points out so well in his article on the book, The Purpose-Driven Life, the emphasis on the fact that Christianity is about now, not about eternity. No, it's about experiencing the tests and trials and sufferings that God brings into our lives now to constantly ask us the question, are you more interested in eternity than you are in the now? And yet, most of the books that you buy are about how to make life, make Christianity work for you now. So, my point being this, that I can use the same terminology as all these other teachers, and in fact, it's probably a good idea for me to do so. So I don't give the impression that I am anti-Christianity. But as soon as I use the same terminology as they do, I then go on to say, however, I disagree with you on what those terms mean, how to define them, and let me explain to you what I think the more biblical way to understand those terms actually is. So on the one hand, I don't want to offend people by giving the appearance that I'm anti-God and anti-Christianity. On the other hand, I don't mind offending people humbly, graciously. I ain't Jesus. I ain't Paul. I'm not going to be perhaps as confident as they were. And after all, you know, Jesus was the incarnate God. So I won't maybe sound exactly the way he does, but I won't mind offending people if that's really what ends up happening. They may get mad at me. People have gotten mad at me. You've probably seen this happen in your own life too, when you start to talk about the sovereignty of God. No, I believe that God is absolutely sovereign. You what? You know, and most of the Christians out there are going, as I've heard two leading Christians in the American Christian community say, God had nothing to do with the tsunami a year ago in Indonesia. God had nothing to do with Hurricane Katrina. You go, God, what Bible are you reading? My Bible says it's something completely different from that. And you suggest that God had everything to do with both of those disasters and every detail of those disasters, and people just get plain mad. They're offended. That's our job, is to offend them graciously, humbly, by saying, no, I really think this is how you should define the word sovereignty. or the word Christianity. Okay. I went a little longer than 30 minutes. Sorry. Why don't we end there? And I have one more application, but if I get a chance to talk about that, I will. But I want to give you a chance. This, I think, is kind of the heart of what's going on here, especially in the context of Matthew 15 and Matthew 23. So I want to give you a chance to make some comments or ask questions about it if you'd like to.
This may be a little bit different. I think God is sovereign.
Yeah.
But I think he uses instruments to do things that he's not, how can I say, directly involved in, but he is sovereign.
Okay.
And those things won't happen without him letting them happen.
Okay. All right.
I mean, is that
kind of
how you look at it too?
No. Be honest with you. No. What's your name, by the way?
My name's Richard.
Richard. Okay. I'm Earl. Richard. Yeah. Nice to meet you.
But anyway, thank you.
Yeah. I appreciate your question. And that's, I keep going with that. It's a long answer to your question. No, my view is actually different. There's a good book out. I'm trying to think of the title of it here. I'm being funny, Richard. I don't know. Do you know Jack Crabtree?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Are you familiar with his book?
Actually not.
The Most Real Being.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit like reading Kant. Mm-hmm. All right. Kind of rough sledding. But I'd recommend that you actually pick up that book and read it. In addition, do you get News and Views? The newsletter from Gutenberg College?
Well, I'm just sort of coming back. I did earlier. I'm just really coming back to here now.
Well, the reason I bring that up is that Robbie has been kind enough to, in the next issue, is going to have an article of mine called Thinking About Katrina, where I draw from the story of Job to talk about that. And so,
in that, I'm not trying to say that I really disagree with you on that.
Okay.
You know, I believe firmly that God has the sovereignty, but I feel many times that he allows things to happen. He doesn't directly do those.
Okay.
But, again, I want to stress that those things will not happen unless he lets them.
Okay. All right. I think one can use both words, actually. There are parts of the Bible where the language of allowing, permission, in the book of Acts, I can't remember exactly where it is. I think it's on the right-hand side of the page, about a third of the way down.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't find exactly in Job
talking
about either.
Sure. Even that notion of Satan coming to God and asking for permission, and God saying, do this, but don't do that. So you definitely get that sense. And yet other passages that teach us, I believe, that God actually is directly directing those circumstances.
Oh, yeah. I believe there are circumstances. That's what I'm trying to make a point of.
Okay.
That there are circumstances where God directly intervenes, and there are circumstances where he allows things to happen.
Okay.
And I think we're being a little presumptuous when we say God did this or did that.
Okay.
I think we should say, well, God did this or he allowed. And since he's sovereign, it cannot happen without his permission.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Melanie? Hi, Melanie. Thanks for sending those books, by the way, Melanie.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Do you think Jesus sees Peter as exempt from the tax?
Yeah. I was afraid somebody was going to raise that question. I don't think so. Even though the parable includes, do I look like Jack here, by the way? I do this. Jack does this. So the Summer Institute, my son just absolutely embarrassed the heck out of him. I'm going to answer your question here in just a second. I better do it quickly because we're running out of time. But in a skit that that my son wrote for the Summer Institute, that several of the attendees then acted out, my son showed me that I guess I have certain hand motions that I do that I was not even aware of, and I think probably Jack wasn't aware of the ones that he does either. And so I'm totally self-conscious now about the way I talk. I can keep my hands behind me. Even though the parable identifies the sons as being plural, I think that the point is singular.
And yet, what Jesus does for Peter is say, but I'm going to pay, let me show you something. I'm going to go beyond just paying my tax with this miracle. I'm going to pay yours too. Now, there's a question about, well, what about all the other apostles that were probably hanging around them there in the house? I don't have a clue. Not sure. Except that there's so much that seems to be pointed directly to Peter, that Jesus wants to teach Peter something, drive it into his head that he is the Messiah, both by the parable as well as by the miracle, that maybe all Jesus wanted to have in mind at this time was the only person that he wanted to have in mind was Peter.
Okay, so this interaction he had with Peter immediately prior to where he says that he's going to pay the tax to not offend is very Christological. He's making the point to Peter that I'm the Messiah, I'm the Son of God. I'm wondering if instead of showing an unusual cultural sensitivity to the Pharisees, that he's just not ready to overtly proclaim that he's the Son of God there. And that's why he doesn't want to offend, because they're not idiots. They could probably make the connection just as well if he's saying that I don't need to pay the tax.
I hadn't really thought about that. Probably need to think about that some more. My sort of immediate response would be the word offend. So that we don't, that I wonder if he wouldn't have used a different word. So that I don't show my hand, that I really am the Son of God, I'm going to go ahead and pay it. Instead, it's this word scandalize, so that I don't scandalize them. I'm not going to pay it. But, you know, interesting suggestion. I'll think about it.
Especially when I was thinking that when you contrast that with the other examples, where he really doesn't care whether he's ticking them off or not, but he's not really overtly proclaiming I'm God incarnate to them in those other situations either.
One other idea, is it Brian, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, Brian. One other idea is this whole notion that starting going back to the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus is saying he is fulfilling the Torah, the Mosaic Covenant. And so I wonder if it's kind of more in that vein that he's saying, I want to show them that I'm actually the fulfillment of the Mosaic Covenant. I'm right in line with it by paying this tax. I'm going to stay in line with it because of who I am. That's so another idea just I want to throw out there. Hi, Terry.
I'm curious if you think that this tax was required. I mean, back in Exodus, it's obviously required for the one time. And I, from what you've read in those other passages in the Old Testament, it doesn't look like it was something proclaimed by God to do.
Yeah.
But it was a good idea, maybe.
Yes. Required, I think, if you could distinguish between a requirement where God would say, you've got to do this, let's say, every year. You've got to collect this tax. Versus a requirement that simply comes out of the principle of, if the building that I have designated to be the one where I dwell, God speaking here, and where you're to worship me, falls into disrepair, then use this principle to say to the people, it is a requirement that the nation of Israel, the Jews, maintain the building and collect the tax that way. So can you see the kind of difference in
that requirement?
That
could be another one-time tax, though, rather than an annual.
No, that's true. And the annual thing, in Nehemiah chapter 10, the people just simply said, I think out of the gratitude of their hearts, they had returned from Babylon, they had been allowed to rebuild their temple. See, I use that word, Richard, there we go. And they had rebuilt the walls. That they're just saying, you know what? We want to make sure that this thing gets maintained year after year. We're committing ourselves to an annual tax in that regard. Yeah, I know I'm keeping you longer than I should. How about Unamas? One more.
If the Pharisees had come and challenged Jesus on the same issue. Do you think his response could have been different?
Would you repeat the question? No, just kidding. Just kidding. I guess I could envision where he would say, you know, you guys don't get it.
I am the temple. So start paying me and just get right in their faces. But, you know, because of some other aspect to this situation, which I can't think of or I'm not aware of, just reading this the text as it is, he wants to say, no, I'm going to go ahead and go along with it.
Usually in Jesus' interaction with the Pharisees, they also start with a question, but it's not a real question. It's a challenge. It seems to me that it's possible that here this is more of a real question.
Yeah.
I mean, there may be a difference in the spirit in which this is presented than he sees with the Pharisees.
Okay. All right. Appreciate that. That's good. Thanks, David. If you have any other questions, I'll be glad to answer those afterwards. What do you do to end here? Just get up and walk out? Say goodbye? Well, thank you, though, for your attention and for the opportunity to explore this with you. I appreciate it, and have a great day and a great week. And